Welcome to Stories of Stories. I'm your host, Mike Chin. In each edition of this podcast, I explore the stories behind a specific creative project, process, or experience. I'll be talking about projects on this show with the expectation that either you're already familiar with the project I'm talking about, so for example, if it's a story, you've already read it, or you don't plan to read it. Regardless, what I'm trying to get at is this podcast will include all kinds of spoilers, so please listen no further if you don't want anything spoiled. This episode, I'll be discussing the Leo Burke Finish. This is my chapbook, which was published in the summer of 2016 with Gimmick Press. I wanted to start this one kind of in reverse order in talking about this project, because it kind of begins with finding out about Gimmick Press in general. One of my professors at the Oregon State MFA program, Elena Passarello, referred me to a call for submissions that Gimmick Press put out for its first project, which was an anthology called Working Stiff, which collected a variety of works in a variety of genres related to professional wrestling. And obviously that seemed like a project I would really want to be a part of. I had written a story just a few months before that I was really happy with called Finishers, which I've talked about in a previous podcast. And I decided, that this was a story that I felt really seriously about. I wanted to revise it carefully and find a good home for it. And then on a similar note, just with this project coming out, it's something that I felt as though if there's going to be a collection of pro wrestling literature, I've got to be a part of that. That just felt like kind of such a natural fit. And so I wanted to kind of give it my best shot and give them, a story that I really thought would hold up. So I ended up submitting Finishers for that anthology. It ended up, being accepted and being a part of that book. I still, really enjoy that book. It's one that just has such a wide array of voices included in it. Including some folks who I think, kind of identify more overtly as writers about wrestling, as well as a bunch of folks who I think it's just kind of a one-off project that they happen to write about wrestling, for that individual one. And I think as such, it kind of represents kind of a diverse perspective on the business and how it can be represented in art. But it was coming out of that project that the editor, Josh Olson, reached out to the previous contributors to announce this chapbook contest. He was calling it the three-way dance. And the idea was that that they would solicit these chapbook submissions, and then he would select a winning three out of whatever number of submissions he received, and publish them together as one book under the three-way dance banner as Gimmick Press's next project. And I distinctly remember when I got the email, because I was in New York at the time. I was living in Oregon, but I was traveling in New York City for an a cappella competition, and I remember, kind of just being really busy, and, I saw the message come through and was like, that sounds like a really cool project, but I don't think I have anything immediately ready, and I'm not gonna, be able to write something in time for the deadline for this contest, so, it'd probably just be one of those things that, kind of came and went, and, maybe down the road, if they did another project similar to this, maybe I would try to be a part of it. But then I started thinking more about it, and actually had quite a few poems, over 20 of them, that I'd written in the past year related to wrestling, as well as a lyric essay that I was pretty proud of. And I thought, well, what if I were to just assemble these into a chapbook? It wouldn't really be that much work at this point to just kind of put them all in one document and give it a careful proofread and then send it off. And if it didn't win anything, that's fine. I wouldn't have invested that much in it. And if it did, that'd be a pretty cool thing to have this project also published with Gimmick Press. And so that's what I did, and I was pleasantly surprised when that following fall I got the email from Josh letting me know that it had been selected as a manuscript for this project and that they're going to go ahead with it. So that was pretty exciting. But I thought for this podcast, though, I'd kind of from here zero in on some specific pieces from the project. So, you know, as I've done with poems in the past, I'm going to read some selected poems outright, and then I'll talk about kind of a couple of pieces of the project, you know, more broadly. But so let me go ahead and read this first poem I'm going to read. It's actually the very first one that appears in my section of the chapbook. It's also one of the first wrestling prose poems that I drafted. It's called The Falls. The Undertaker threw Mick Foley off the top of a steel cage. Play-by-play man Jim Ross, purportedly unwarned about the stunt, broke character and screamed, "They've killed him." They, not the Undertaker, but management, callous and reckless enough to subject human bodies to this level of punishment, choreographed or not. But Foley wasn't dead. Wrestling had taught me all manner of things. Hulk Hogan body-slamming Andre the Giant, that I might have strength. The Macho Man's top rope elbow drop, that I might fly. But Foley's crash, in that moment, I learned that I might fall. For Foley, after crashing and after being loaded onto the gurney, fought to his feet and scaled the cage again, traded blows again, fought until he was slammed through the roof of the cage to the ring below. Two great falls. And still. Still Foley fought, half unconscious, a molar lodged in his nostril. It took a choke slam and a pile driver onto a mat littered with thumbtacks, no less, to incapacitate him once and for all, for him to accept defeat. Still, nearly 20 years gone by, this memory lives on in wrestling lore, no less prominent than any Hogan slam, than the time when Bruno Sammartino reigned as world champion for 8 straight years. For it is not in falling that he, that we, that all of mankind fails. It is in falling that we might rise. Okay, so that was The Falls. And you know, and as I mentioned, that's one of the first wrestling prose poems that I wrote. Not the first. We'll actually get into that a little bit later on. But it's one that I think I really had kind of, you know, hit my stride in writing these things and capturing sort of an important moment in wrestling history. And I think that's something where... for better or worse, some of my later poems, I think, related to wrestling, kind of veered away from kind of what was more universally understandable, away from the more iconic moments in wrestling and characters in wrestling, into things that really it'd be hard to kind of get into unless you were already sort of invested in that world of wrestling. But for this one, you know, I think that it succeeded because it was more accessible, and because what it kind of does, I think, is take something that is relatively esoteric in this world of pro wrestling and makes it into something almost divine, into kind of this mythic moment worthy of kind of encapsulating as an image in a poem, which I think is one of the real challenges of writing about wrestling in kind of a literary format, is to make it clear that it's not just kind of the barbarity of, you know, people fighting and punching each other in a steel cage, but to capture these more kind of beautiful moments in a sense, and kind of what they might represent to a broader culture. So speaking of what things might represent to a broader culture, though, the next one I'm going to read is called You Might Have Trouble. After 9/11, Amanda said that she bet airline security was going to get tighter. She looked all the way around our dorm room circle and landed on my face. You might have trouble. I have black hair and yellow-brown skin. In high school, in a district of pasty white faces, I was Chinese. Not half Chinese, not Asian American, no hyphens or halfways, just different. Other. In college, I thought I passed for white, had been asked if I were Greek or Italian. Then this. This. There was a wrestler who debuted in WWE in 2004, billed as Muhammad Hassan. The character had a chip on his shoulder, angry for the past 3 years he'd been followed in grocery stores, eyed by police officers, that mothers steered their children clear of him at airports. "I'm American," he protested, but the crowd's jeering in arena after arena grew louder. A rare villain who'd done nothing wrong. A villain with a grievance who was actually, obviously right. A crystallizing moment. The Royal Rumble. A 30-man battle in which one by one combatants enter the ring at timed intervals, only to be eliminated when another wrestler throws him over the top rope to the floor. There could only be one winner, As the cliche goes, it's every man for himself. But this time, when Hassan entered the ring, the match stopped. A sea of men stopped, staring, then sprung into action. The stories was that they all had ambitions, and they didn't all get along, but they could all agree that Hassan had to go. It was one of the quickest, most collaborative eliminations in the 18-year history of the match. Then this. July 4th, 2005, the nuance, the complexity of Hassan's character fell away at a TV taping. He summoned five men in black ski masks to attack The Undertaker and choke him with piano wire. In a particularly poor twist of fate, the episode aired 3 days later, hours after terrorists bombed London. The network demanded that Hassan never appear on their show again. So, Hassan was off TV. On a July 24th pay-per-view spectacular, The Undertaker chokeslammed and pinned Hassan in the ring, but that was not enough. Then this. As Hassan crawled away to the backstage area, The Undertaker stalked him, up to the stage where wrestlers flexed and posed when they made their entrances and as they celebrated their victories. He caught up to Hassan, lifted him high, and powerbombed him through the stage to the floor, until Hassan was destroyed. Until Hassan was gone. Until Hassan was forgotten. And the man behind the character, Mark Copani, an American of Italian descent, had followed in a tradition of men representing different identities. Rodney Adnoy, the Samoan-American born in San Francisco, who waved a Japanese flag and wore sumo garb as Yokozuna. Nelson Simpson, the Minnesotan who played the Russian nightmare Nikita Koloff at the height of the Cold War. Perhaps most apropos of all, Sergeant Slaughter, all-American hero turned Iraqi sympathizer during the first Gulf War so he could play the foil against Hulk Hogan. WWE released Capani. He never wrestled again. And this. The year is 2016. I'm in graduate school without any obligations for the winter break, and for the first time in my life, I grow a beard. As it fills out, as it thickens, I elect to keep it for the weeks to follow. Let it grow bigger, bushier, more pronounced. I catch up with an old friend as he passes through town. I'm not thinking about the fact that he hasn't seen me since I started growing my beard. Then this. What the hell? You look like a terrorist. I remember. You might have trouble. I remember this. Okay, so that was You Might Have Trouble. And this is a poem that, again, we talk about kind of engaging with the broader culture. This is one of a couple of poems in this collection where I felt as though I was engaging more with, real social issues. And I felt as though, one of the hidden values, I think, in watching professional wrestling is kind of the way in which it offers commentary on the surrounding culture. And I think, people are pretty quick to dismiss it as, just kind of being this lowbrow, entertainment form that doesn't really say anything and kind of plays the lowest common denominator. And there's some truth to that. I mean, it's not as though it's a history that's, clear of any, kind of problematic portrayals of specific characters and minorities and, people from abroad. There's definitely been some misogyny in the history of the wrestling business. And so, that all makes sense. But when you look at a case like Muhammad Hassan, I actually think that he's sort of a tragic figure in wrestling history because it's this, young man who was kind of a blue chip prospect and was cast in this kind of controversial character and one that actually was pretty artfully conveyed in the early going. He was set up to be someone who had a legitimate gripe, as the poem kind of indicates, as someone who was kind of discriminated against based on the character being Arab American, and then eventually just kind of slowly becomes this villain who people have cast him as, kind of in response to that. So I think. It's interesting to look at that, and then we also just kind of see the way that, whether it's WWE management or whether it's the pro wrestling culture, whether it's the fans, they just kind of takes a shift, just become more this kind of overtly stereotypical villainous character. And it's especially interesting to me now that, I think that, a lot of time has passed. When people talk about this character now, there is some controversy about whether, in that last instance he was supposed to be portraying a terrorist. The character claimed that he wasn't, that these people were you know, just kind of his sympathizers, I think they pitched it as. But you know, it seems pretty overt what WWE was trying to kind of capture a bit clumsily in that moment. But you know, there came a time, you know, I've noted on the podcast before, I write a pro wrestling column for a site called 411 Mania, and I once wrote a column about, you know, moments when WWE had made social commentary, whether it was overt and intentional or whether it was just kind of implicit, in the programming they put forward. And I cited Hassan specifically as this, you know, pretty profound example of, you know, what the company was and was not prepared to address, and, you know, kind of how they conveyed these more complex ideas and kind of the failings of it. It got a ton of backlash for it. And it wasn't really thoughtful backlash in my opinion. It was more just kind of like, this is just entertainment, dude, chill out. Don't try to make this into a political thing, or, you know, or no, you completely misunderstood the character. You know, he was just a villain the whole time, and that's, he was him just making excuses. And some of these points are arguable, but kind of the lack of willingness to engage with the topic in that way was sort of disappointing to me. And it's kind of one of the things I think I've found in writing about wrestling from a more literary perspective to be really rewarding, is I can engage these ideas a little bit more. And the audience that's kind of reading a literary journal or reading a chapbook, I think it's a little bit more willing to kind of engage these ideas in a complex fashion than the typical reading audience of a pro wrestling website. So I'm going to read this next poem here. This one is called Sex Tape. I heard there was a Hulk Hogan sex tape, that he sleeps with his friend's wife, and it may or may not have been his friend filming. I heard Hulk knew he was on tape. I heard that he didn't. I heard he was angry. And I remember an awakening, a boy watching Andre the Giant squeeze Hulk's body in a bear hug, all the sweat on sweat and skin on skin and groans and screams. I haven't sought out footage from the sex tape. I don't want to see it. And yet it harkens back. Discovery, curiosity, shame. Hulk in red knee pads and yellow spandex, bright as the sun, too bright to look at straight on. Okay, so this poem obviously is engaging with Hulk Hogan and his infamous sex tape that came out. Part of why I wanted to read this one is this was in the initial set of five prose poems about Hulk Hogan that I crafted. This kind of came out of, initially I was working on this kind of series of autobiographical prose poems. I had taken a class in hybrid forms at Oregon State that I referenced before, in, I believe it was the fall of 2015. That'd be fall of 2014. No, not 2015. I think that seems right. I always get confused with the years at that point. But in any event, I took that class in the fall, and then that following January, I had a schedule that kind of left my mornings for the most part open, and so I had some time when I was usually alone at home and able to dedicate some time to writing, and I made it this personal challenge to throughout that month of January, at least the weekdays, every day to write at least one prose poem. It opened up a lot of things for me. It gave me some good practice in the form, and starting to kind of learn how to kind of navigate that form and what it can and can't do. And then towards the very end of it, it's strange that it took me this long, knowing who I am, but I finally started writing these poems about wrestling, and it was the series of five poems about Hulk Hogan in particular that got the ball rolling on that. And I think that speaks to him being just kind of this iconic figure, in the wrestling business and in my personal history. But a part of the project was to kind of evaluate kind of his history and kind of these singular important developments or iconic moments. So I captured one where it was about Hulk Hogan versus Andre the Giant at WrestleMania 3, which is one of the most famous wrestling matches of all time. One about him, finally turning heel, starting the New World Order in WCW in 1996. Him facing The Rock kind of after that when he came back to WWE at WrestleMania 18. And then I had Sex Tape, and then I had The Word, which are kind of about kind of the controversies he's been involved in after his time in kind of the limelight of wrestling. And so Sex Tape obviously refers to that sex tape that leaked, and The Word refers to the audio recordings that leaked of him using the N-word repeatedly in conversation. And so part of why I think these are, you know, relatively important poems, I think, again, they kind of engage with some social issues and kind of in the psyche of the wrestling fan. You know, and I you called on some you know, memories and reflections of kind of, you know, what wrestling may have meant to me at a younger age and kind of my perceptions of Hulk Hogan here. You know, this was a poem that I was really proud of, and of those initial ones, kind of the one that I felt you know, most kind of nailed the dynamic I was going for, and I think kind of spurred me on to write all the ones that followed. And you know, and I think it kind of goes to show that that was the one that I was able to publish online with Prairie Schooner, which is one of my more prestigious publications. When they did a call for kind of sports related poetry, it just the stars kind of aligned. I was able to submit that to them, and was really happy that that worked out. And then the rest of the Hulk Hogan kind of themed poems all wound up being published with another magazine called Vanilla Sex Magazine as a big set that I was really happy with. But okay, I think I'm just going to read one more poem here. So this one is about a more recent star in the professional wrestling business. And I think, you know, that's part of where it was a bit of a challenge to kind of provide just enough context to make you know, people who don't care about wrestling kind of, you know, understand what was going on in this poem without, you know, over kind of flowing it with you know, too much context and too much about wrestling and kind of just being a fan. I know when I started sending this one out to journals, that was one of the pieces of feedback I received, was that this feels like just it's just kind of a, you know, a play-by-play of something happening in wrestling. You know, and I think kind of missed what I was going for in this poem, but by the same token, I get it, because it's, you know, it's a foreign form to them, and because there is some context woven into it, you know, you could read it as more just kind of informative as opposed to artful. But in any event, it was pretty well received, and particularly, I think, after it came out in the chapbook, it received a little bit better reception of the poems in the collection. So this one is called How to Apply the Figure Eight. It's about Charlotte Flair, the daughter of Ric Flair, who had more recently emerged as a star with WWE, and at least as of this recording, is still a pretty famous wrestler with them. How to Apply the Figure Eight. Step 1. Work the knee. Just like your father told you, or, more to the point, your brothers. When you were children, when David and Reed talked about winning the tag team championships, when they daydreamed about being the first brothers to duel for the World Heavyweight Championship in the main event of Starrcade, and started trading headlocks into hammerlocks, David was bigger, 9 years older, a teenager at play. Reed had the fire in his eyes, even then, the instinctive knowledge of bodies and how they bend, a child, but not at play, competing. Work the knee to soften your opponent. Work the knee to let the crowd know how the match will go. Work the knee until the climax. Woo! The figure four leg lock. Step 2. Knock them down. There's no applying a leg lock when your opponent still stands. So chop the chest, punch the chin, clip the hamstring, get her down. Down. Down on the ground. You flung yourself there when your father wasn't home for your 6th birthday, when you said you didn't want to ride the pony, you wanted daddy. Down, down, down. Monday night, you saw not only your father, but your brother on the TV screen. When Hulk Hogan took off his weight belt and whipped David bloody, your father called home that night to comfort your mother, to tell her that her son was okay, and in the same breath call Hogan a no-good son of a bitch. You could hear him through the receiver. When your mother pulled it from her ear, he spoke so loudly, I'll never forgive him. Step 3. Center. If your opponent reaches the ropes, you have to break the hold. So start from the center, the maximum distance from any side of the ring. Besides, the point that invites the best camera angles, over, through, and under the ropes. Smile for the cameras. You said the boys could have their wrestling. You played volleyball. From high school to NCAA Division I, blazing your own trail, focused, driven. Step 4. Apply the spinning toe hold. No, it's not essential, but it's a cue, popularized by your father. It lets the fans know what's coming. It makes the move look that much more technical, complicated, the likes of which no jabroni at home could have the skill to do it right. While you were bumping, setting, spiking, Reed was learning to fall, learning to take the hits, transitioning from amateur to pro, learning to add flash to substance, flash over substance, to give the people their money's worth, to give the people a show. Following your father's footsteps, God, your father was proud. Step 5. Drop. The spinning toe hold leaves your opponent's ankle over her knee, legs in a figure 4, your shin at the center. You drop. Reed dropped, showing you the figure 4 in the hotel room, grappling like you were kids again, late at night after the exec your father invited to dinner to sell him on Reed studied your musculature and asked when you were getting in the ring. You have to do this, Reed said, after, not jealous, inspired, that you might share in your father's legacy. Reed dropped, after you'd said yes, after you started training. Just before he was supposed to see you wrestle live, he OD'd on heroin. Another wrestling tragedy, the media said, as if it were a genre of death, easy to categorize, not a surprise, not an anomaly, something we'd all seen before. And you dropped to your knees. Step 6. Plant your leg. The back of your knee over the dangling end of that 4, over her ankle, bending the ankle and driving it into her knee. Dual pressure points. She screams. You didn't stop training, though you wanted to. Didn't leave wrestling behind, but rather put Reed's dreams on your shoulders. Carried the weight. Carried through developmental. Carried it to the WWE, where you were the one wrestling Monday nights. Now it was all on you. Step 7. Bridge. No one taught you this part, but you're more limber than your father or your brothers ever were, besides which this modern age demands a modern hold. So you stretch your arms back. Palms down, press up, back arching, arching, arching as far as you can go. The extra pressure makes the hold more painful. The extra sizzle makes the fans go wild. Your father sits at ringside, tears in his eyes. Step 8. Win. She taps the mat. She taps your leg. She screams her surrender because she can't take it anymore. And this lifetime, this childhood without your father, this death of your brother, these sore bones and muscles all seem as though they had a payoff, a moment of redemption and vindication. Your father holds you in his arms so tight, sobbing. He can't stop telling you he loves you. The ring bell clangs, the crowd rumbles as your music, that was your father's music, plays through the stadium, throughout a dark city. For now, it is you who reigns. Okay, so that was How to Apply the Figure Eight. So again, that was about Charlotte Flair and kind of in particular capturing a moment she won a big match, WrestleMania 32, and they transitioned. They'd been calling the whole women's division and his championship by the Diva moniker or brand. And, you know, Charlotte Flair was among a set of wrestlers that kind of helped usher in a more serious period of women's wrestling for WWE. And they renamed it just the Women's Championship that night. So she was the winner of that title on that evening. And so, this one, it's broken into the 8 steps, and that kind of mirrors the hold, the figure 8. I liked that as a formal choice. And I think it fits with kind of the story of Charlotte Flair's father Rick. His signature hold was the figure 4 leg lock. So Charlotte and kind of applying the figure 4 and then arching her body kind of forms the shape of an 8 with her body and her opponents, and renamed or kind of rebranded the hold in that name. It was a poem that I was really happy to write, and again I think it's one that was a little harder to connect to for some non-wrestling fans who read it. And I think for those who were wrestling fans, I think it's one they really appreciated. And it kind of blends a few pieces. It's kind of an experimental structure for the poem. And then in addition to that, you know, it does get into some actual facts, some actual history, in terms of, you know, she really did have her brother Reed, who did OD, you know, and passed away before his career really got off the ground. But, you know, there was a famous, you know, meeting that Charlotte Flair has spoken pretty openly about, where, you know, her father took them out to dinner with, I believe it was John Laurinaitis, who was the executive vice president of talent relations for WWE for a long time. And, you know, he was kind of trying to sell him on Reed Flair and bringing him in. And Laurinaitis, you know, reportedly, you know, looked at Charlotte and just kind of asked, you know, well, when are you getting into the business? And that was kind of part of the impetus for her, you know, really starting this journey. So, you know, collecting these real moments, but then also sprinkling in some more speculative pieces. You know, that moment of Hulk Hogan whipping David Flair, that's pretty famously, you know, an incident that did go kind of off script. Where Hogan was supposed to whip David, you know, once or twice, but ended up doing it a ton of times and actually, you know, bloodying him up and beating him pretty badly. You know, and Ric Flair was reportedly, you know, really upset about that at the time. So capturing that moment, but speculating on what it would have been like for, you know, Flair to call home and, you know, talk to the family about that part is just purely kind of, you know, me imagining the outcome. That may or may not be true, how that kind of went down. And there are a lot of other pieces like that where, you know, it's speculating. It's things I think, you know, very reasonably could have been a part of this story, but there's not really a factual account of. And so kind of blending, you know, kind of myth with fact and speculation to compose this poem. So that's all I'm going to actually read from the chapbook. There's the title essay, which I'm also, you know, pretty proud of. I'll just reference it briefly. You know, so it's called The Leo Burke Finish, and it's pulling a line from Bret Hart's memoir, Hitman, My Real Life in the Cartoon World of Wrestling, where he talks about, you know, Leo Burke, who was a famous Canadian wrestler who he looked up to earlier in his life. And later on, he's referring to these two particular finishes to matches, one match with Davey Boy Smith, one match with his brother Owen Hart, but it was particularly Davey Boy Smith match from SummerSlam 1992, where Hart goes for a sunset flip, and Davey Boy Smith just kind of, you know, drops down on him, you know, kneeling down on his shoulders and hooking his legs. It's kind of a beautiful pinning combination and a beautiful ending to this match, where it's not a matter of one man, you know, kind of beating the other senseless or, you know, forcing him to quit, but rather just kind of holding him down and just in that moment kind of being the more successful wrestler. And Hart describes that, you know, in pretty great detail and calls it the Leo Burke finish, kind of in reference to Leo Burke negotiating some similar situations and matches, you know, earlier on in wrestling history. You know, I pull on that moment, and, you know, I do refer to it pretty explicitly in the essay, but more generally, it's kind of this combination of my life story through the filter of being a wrestling fan and talking about wrestling history that was going on, you know, while I was a kid and into my adulthood. And it's something where it intertwines these two pieces of kind of, you know, life and wrestling. And I think it speaks to the fact that everything really is intertwined. You know, I can't really earnestly tell my life story without making some references to wrestling. If you wanted to be a purist about it, you could do it through a lot of different lenses. You could do it through a lens of me being a writer. You could do it through a lens of, you know, all of my personal relationships. You could do it through a lens of, you know, being a fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I'm sure. You know, any of these given things I was really committed to for an extended period of time. I talk a lot about kind of the relationship between my father and my grandfather and myself and kind of connections between us. And, you know, there's a lot that we don't have in common, and wrestling really was kind of one of those common bonds, especially in my youth, that, you know, did bring us together to an extent. And then I talk about, you know, my life with Heather, my wife now, and the moment when I proposed to her and some of the earlier points in our relationship, and cite kind of this idea that, you know, wrestling couldn't be a secret in this situation. And, you know, the longest relationship I had had previous to this that had gone for about 4 years, I'd spent a good bit of that trying to hide the fact that I was a wrestling fan, because I knew that it wasn't, you know, kind of cool, or it was kind of lowbrow. And in this case, you recognize I'm going to build a life with this person. I need to be honest about who I am. I think that essay is one I'm pretty proud of. And the way that it's all kind of set up in this collection is I believe it's 23 prose poems followed by that lyric essay. that are all kind of combined together for the chapbook of the Leo Burke finish. And again, that's part of the three-way dance project. And there are a bunch more poems in there that I could discuss. In particular, there's some about, you know, world-class championship wrestling that never actually found homes with literary journals. I think they were a little bit too insider, a little bit too kind of esoteric. And this chapbook was sort of an ideal home for them. But in any event, it was a real pleasure to work with Josh Olson over at Gimmick Press. Just kind of a guy who really clearly cares about his authors that he's working with. And he's become sort of what I call a Twitter friend, where, you know, I've never met him in person, at least as of the time that I'm recording this. But, you know, we have engaged over there, and he's eager to promote, you know, work that I do, that whether it's related to this project or not. And I hope I will have a chance to work with him again at some point. Okay, so we'll move ahead here now to Mike's monthly endorsement. So as an artist, I do think it's important to be consuming other things to see what interests and inspires you, and to see, you know, what came before you, what else is out there. So at the end of episodes, I'm recommending a book, story, movie, TV show, a band, a wrestling match, etc., that may have escaped a huge mainstream audience or might be a little bit dated now and at the cusp of being forgotten, but that I recommend. So in this case, I'm going to recommend another chapbook. This one is by my friend Dennis Sweeney. It's called Threats. It's a collection of poems, and it's inspired by a novel by the same name. Dennis just kind of sees the world like no one else I've ever met. And he's someone who was really just kind of inspirational to me as not only a personal friend during our time in Oregon, but also as a hybrid writer. When I first met him, I don't think I really understood what hybrid meant. And I still don't entirely know that I do, even though I consider myself a writer in that kind of subgenre myself. Dennis kind of fully embraces it and has a real command of voice. He's just a real skilled author who, I met as a fiction writer when we were in Oregon, but he also was an active poet at that time as well. I think that this is a really impressive collection to read. It was a handmade book produced by Alice Blue Books. Unfortunately, that publisher has since closed, but the book itself is still available directly from Dennis if you go to his website at dennisjamessweeney.com. All right, well, as always, I want to thank everyone for taking the time to listen, and in particular, I want to thank Mike Peake for the theme music for this show. I'm wishing you all good health, happiness, and creativity, and I'll catch you next time.